Minus 9. Lead us down a hallway, covered in works of art that would probably fetch a small fortune at a museum auction. I still can't believe a dude like Nine lives here. I feel like I should be wearing a tuxedo just walking around. As we walk through the penthouse, Sarah and Six break off to get cleaned up from the road, and Ella excuses herself to go help Nine put away the gear. Eventually, John stops in the middle of the hallway. "This one's free," John says, opening a door for Five. "There are some extra clothes in the drawers, too, in case you feel like a change." "Thanks," Five says, trudging into the room. He's about to slam the door, but realizes we're all lingering outside, kinda staring at him. "See you guys dinner, I guess," he mutters, before closing the door. "Cool, dude," 8 says, dryly. Marina elbows him in the ribs and shushes him. I glance towards the closed door, where I bet 5 is still standing, listening. I feel a little sorry for him again. It isn't easy being an outsider. John turns to my dad and me. "Are you guys beat too? Or do you want the grand tour?" "Nah," I say. "Lead on. This is my first penthouse."
"Mine too," my dad adds, smiling.
"Awesome," John replies, looking relieved that we aren't being as antisocial as 5. "I think you guys are really going to like the next stop." My dad trails a few feet behind the group, admiring the artwork. Once we've continued down the hallway and put 5's room out of earshot, 8 asks the question that I think most of us are thinking. "What's with the new guy?" He glances over at me.
"Not you, Sam. You seem perfectly normal."
"Thanks." John shakes his head, looking a little bewildered.
"I don't know, honestly. He's a little strange, right? Not exactly what I was expecting."
"He's probably just nervous," Marina adds. "He'll settle in."
"Where's his Saipan?" I ask. "What has he been doing all these years?"
"He was pretty closed off the whole car ride back," John answers. "Even Sarah couldn't get much out of him. And you know how she is."
"Yeah. She's social enough to get you secretive Lorik talking about pretty much anything."
John chuckles, catching my joke right away. "Sarah is so charming she could convince an on-the-run alien to get his picture taken for the school paper.
So charming that same alien might even throw rocks at her window in the middle of the night, even if the feds are staking out her house."
8 and Marina exchange a look of confusion as John and I start laughing.
"You threw rocks at Sarah's window?" Marina asks John, her eyebrow cocked in amusement.
"Like Romeo and Juliet?"
Allegedly. According to the FBI.
"Oh, check it out, we're here,"
John says, anxious to change the subject. I smirk at Marina and nod. At the end of the hall, John shows us into a room that looks like the guard had been using for a base of operations. There are huge computer screens on one wall, one of them running a program similar to my dad's web crawler. The Lorik chests are stored here, along with the tablet we recovered from my dad's laboratory. The rest of the room is absolutely cluttered with various pieces of tech. Some of it new and just out of the box, other pieces looking like they were recovered from a junkyard. In some places along the walls, the gadgets and spare parts are piled as high as the ceiling. My dad's face immediately lights up.
"This is quite the collection," he exclaims,
his eyes scanning the room like a kid on Christmas morning. "Nine Saipan, Sander, this was his workshop," explains John.
"We've put some of the stuff to use, but none of us are exactly technological whizzes."
John turns to my father. "I'm hoping you could see if there's anything useful, Mr. Good. Malcolm." My dad rubs his hands together.
"With pleasure, John. It's been too long since I had a place like this at my disposal. I've got a lot of catching up to do."
"I'm also wondering if you could take a look at this," John says, motioning us through a set of double doors. Nine calls it the lecture hall. Entering a huge, high-ceilinged, white room, we pass by an intimidating weapons rack, which makes the guns my dad acquired in Texas look like toys. The room is about the size of our high school's gym,
making me marvel all over again at the overall hugeness of the penthouse. At one end of the room, a large cockpit-style apparatus is built into the wall, an array of consoles set up around it. The chair looks sort of smashed, like something huge fell on top of it.
"Amazing," remarks my dad.
"We've been using this room to train. Nine says that Sander had a bunch of traps and obstacles hooked up at one point." He taps a panel on the wall, where it looks like something should shoot out, but nothing happens.
"Except, Nine threw a temper tantrum and smashed the controls. Now it only sort of works."
"Sounds about right," I say. It's definitely not hard to picture Nine flying off the handle.
"That thing," he says, waving to the chair. "It's called the lectern. If we could get it working again, I think we could really improve our training."
My dad is already kneeling down before the lectern, picking at frayed wires and bent steel plating.
"This is very impressive work," he says.
I examine the machinery over his shoulder, even though I have no idea what I'm looking at. "Can you fix it?"
"I can try," he says, turning back to John. "I'll be of service in any way possible."
"Me too," I say, giving John a quick salute. He chuckles.
"I know you just got here," John says. "I hope I'm not being pushy. Honestly, it's just really good to have you here. And not to get all sappy, but I'm glad you guys found each other."
When John talks about me and my dad, there's a bit of longing in his voice. I wonder if he's thinking about how we could have had this conversation in paradise. My dad and Henri, dorking out about technology together. If only things had played out a little differently. My dad shakes John's hand again, patting him on the arm as he does.
"We're glad we found you, John. I know, it's been hard for all of you, but you're not alone in this. Not anymore."
Chapter 16. Marina really goes overboard with the dinner spread. There are dishes heaped with rice and beans, and fresh tortillas, an iced bowl of gazpacho, some kind of fried honeyed eggplant dish, and like a dozen other Spanish dishes that I don't even know the names of. I've forgotten how good home cooking can be, and I eat wolfishly, going back for seconds and then thirds. We're all seated beneath the glittering chandelier in Nine's banquet hall of a dining room. John sits at one end, my father at the other, and the rest of us in between. I sit next to my father and Nine.
"Crazy," Nine mumbles as he scoops a tortilla into his mouth. "Never had so many people at this table."
Everyone is relaxed, just chatting and joking around. Five eats a lot, but he doesn't say much. Next to him, Ella picks at her food, looking tired, yet still smiling and laughing whenever someone cracks a good joke. Six is sitting right across the table from me. I try to play it cool and not stare at her too much. When the meal is over, John stands up and gets everyone's attention. He glances at Sarah and receives an encouraging smile. He clears his throat, and I can tell he's given a lot of thought to what he's about to say. "It's really incredible to see everyone come together like this. All of us have come so far to be here and gone through so much. Being here, it gives me hope that we could actually win this war." Nine lets out a high-pitched whoop-whoop noise that makes everyone laugh, even cracking John's serious speech-giving face for a moment. Five looks around at everyone, a quiet smile on his face, like he's finally starting to feel more comfortable. "I know, some of us have just met for the first time," John continues. "So I thought it might be helpful if we went around the table and told our stories."
"There's a fun topic," mutters Six.
John is undeterred.
"I know some of the stories, okay, probably all of them, aren't really the happiest. But I think it's important for us to remember how we got here and what we're fighting for."
Looking over at Five, I understand what John is doing. He's hoping that by telling their stories,
The guard might get their newest member to open up a little.
Speaking as one of the new arrivals, I'd really like to hear what you've all been through,
says my dad.
Yeah, Five chimes in, surprising everyone.
Me too.
Okay, says John. I can start.
John launches into a story that's more than familiar to me. He starts during his arrival to Paradise, after years on the road. He talks about meeting Sarah and me, and how it became harder and harder to keep his legacies a secret. John concludes his tale with the battle at our high school, Six's nick of time arrival, and Henri's death. We're all quiet after that, none of us sure what to say.
Oh, damn, Nine says. I almost forgot.
Nine reaches under his chair and produces a bottle of champagne, chilling in a bucket of ice. I shoot a quick look at my dad, but it doesn't look like he's in the mood to play responsible adult. Instead, he holds out his glass. Quickly, Nine circles around the table, pouring for everyone. Even Ella gets a little bit.
Where did this come from? Eight asks.
My secret stash. Don't worry about it.
Finished pouring, Nine raises his glass.
To Henri.
Everyone raises their glasses and toasts Henri. He keeps it together well, but I can tell John is touched by the gesture. He looks down the table and gives Nine a small nod of thanks. Hell, even I'm a little surprised by Nine. Between this and our little heart-to-heart in the doorway earlier, I might have to upgrade him from total douchebag to minor tool.
Maybe you guys should recruit the entire town of Paradise to fight for us, Five says. It sounds like a real alien-friendly place.
We should get that on our bumper stickers, I say.
My honor student fought aliens at Paradise High School.
I can go next, Six says. She keeps her story quick, starting with her capture with Katarina, moving on to their imprisonment, and jumping quickly to her escape.
To Katarina.
This time, it's John leading the toast. Everyone raises their glasses again, and we drink to Six's fallen Saipan.
And that's why you don't post shit on the internet, Nine says, referring to Six's story, but aiming a sharp look in Five's direction.
Five gazes back at Nine, saying nothing.
You were both close with your Saipans, Marina speaks up.
My story is a little different.
Marina tells us about growing up in Spain, how her Saipan, Adelina, basically neglected her, not giving her the training or knowledge that the other guard take for granted. I'm kind of stunned that Aloric would behave that way. It's never occurred to me that they could shirk their responsibilities. It could be a really bitter story, but the way Marina describes, it is sadder than anything else. Her voice gets warm when she talks about Hector, the human who took it upon himself to protect her. In a weird way, the story almost has a happy ending. With Adelina finally accepting her duties, even if it meant dying. I guess that's not super happy, actually. But the way Marina tells it makes it at least seem heroic. Eight raises his glass.
To Hector and Adelina, he says.
Nine goes next. Apparently, it was Nine's fault that everything fell apart in his life. He fell for a human girl who was secretly working for the Mogadorians, and she led him and his Saipan into a trap. Nine glosses over what happened to them once they were captured. Having some first-hand experience with the horrific things that go down in West Virginia, the dark look in Nine's eyes when he finishes doesn't surprise me at all.
To Sander, John says.
To Sander and his champagne, adds Eight,
which gets a smile out of Nine.
I guess you really got lucky, Five says to John, jerking his thumb in Sarah's direction. She could have been a Moog spy, too.
Hey, Sarah replies, not cool.
They forced her, growls Nine, referring to the girl he'd fallen for. No human in their right mind would willingly work for those sons of bitches.
Except the government is, I say, remembering the agents that transported me from West Virginia to Dulce. Nine turns to me. Well, any human that'd work with those albino ash monsters can't be in their right mind.
Or maybe they aren't willing, John says. I have to believe that most humans, if they knew the truth, would be on our side.
I used to distrust humans, says Eight. Reynolds, my Sepan, was betrayed by a woman he'd fallen in love with. It took me a while to get over that, but eventually I came to believe in the inherent good of humanity. Eight goes on to tell us how he learned to control his legacies, and that he eventually came into contact with the local villagers who believed him to be the Hindu god Vishnu reincarnated. Even though the Mogadorians knew his location, they weren't able to get to him because of a human army that protected him. Five studies Eight, nodding, looking like something new and amazing has just occurred to him.
That's great, he says. You tricked them into thinking you were one of their gods.
I didn't mean to trick them, exactly, says Eight defensively. I regret not being more honest.
You shouldn't, continues Five. I mean, it's great. If you can, like, make friends with the humans like John and Marina did. Otherwise, better to have them fighting for you than plotting against you, right?
He glances over at Nine.
Better to be in control than blindly chasing pretty human girls around.
Nine leans forward, like he's about to get out of his seat.
What are you trying to say?
Mistakes have been made, John interjects carefully. But we need to remember that the humans are fighting the same enemy we are. Even if they don't all realize it yet. We can't fight this battle alone. To humanity, I say, jokingly, raising my glass. Everyone looks at me, and I put my glass down, feeling a little lightheaded. It's tense for a moment. Nine is still staring down Five. Ella raises her hand.
I'd like to share, she says.
Her story is unlike any of the others I've heard. She wasn't sent to Earth with the other guard. Instead, her rich, weirdo father shoved her onto a spaceship, along with the family's butler and a bunch of chimera. Looking around the table, I get the sense that not even some of the other guard have heard this whole story. John looks particularly confused, and Six listens intently.
Wow, Ella, John says. When did you learn all this?
Yesterday, she replies, matter-of-factly. It was in Creighton's letter.
Marina raises her glass.
To Creighton,
a great Sepan. Everyone follows suit. Ella's gone quiet. I can tell. This Creighton guy meant a lot to her.
Just think, muses Five. If our spaceship hadn't made it to Earth, you'd have to save the planet all by yourself.
Ella's eyes widen.
I hadn't thought of that.
You could handle it, Nine says, grinning.
So,
John says, looking at Five. We've all told you how we came to be here. Your turn. How have you managed to stay hidden for so long?
Yeah, dude, Eight chimes in. Spill it.
Five slouches down in his chair. For a moment, I think he's just going to stay silent and hope that everyone forgets about him. Like a kid hiding out in the back of a classroom. He's great at making pointed little comments when other people talk, but when it's time to tell his own story, he's more than reluctant.
It's not, exciting, like your stories were.
Five begins after a moment.
We didn't do anything special to stay hidden. We just got lucky, I guess. Found places where the Mogadorians weren't looking for us.
Where was that exactly? John asks.
Islands, answers Five. Tiny islands, where no one would think to look. Some that aren't even on maps. We'd go from island to island, sort of like how you guys traveled from town to town. Every few months, we'd go to one of the more populated places, sometimes Jamaica or Puerto Rico, and trade in some of our gems for supplies. Otherwise, we kept to ourselves.
What happened to your Sepan? Marina gently asks.
I guess I do have that in common with the rest of you guys. He died. His name was Albert.
Mogadorians?